طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. For Palestinians, the pervasive problem of the magnitude of the number of their people held as political prisoners by Israel is overwhelming. Almost every family has experienced at least one of its members being arrested and detained without charges, even children. They are subjected to the Israeli military justice system, not a civil system, as are Israelis. Today we tell the story of a Palestinian political prisoner, but this one, Rami Saf, is being held in Egypt because of his political work there. There is a movement by his friends and family to expose this injustice of his incarceration and pressure the Egyptian government to release him. Unfortunately, this is a typical story in Egypt, as it is in Israel. Today's program focuses on the movement to free Rami Saf. This forum originated as an Arabic Hour production. The forum is moderated by Noura Erekat, Palestinian human rights attorney and an assistant professor at Rutgers University. We begin with Noura Erekat introducing the speakers.
Welcome to Arabic Hour. I'm Noura Erekat, an assistant professor at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and a Jadaliya co-founding editor. Today's program is a collaborative initiative between Jadaliya and the Arabic Hour. Our topic is Egypt's political prisoners of conscience, the case of Rami Saf. Egypt has been much in the news of late about its excessive imprisonment of alleged critics of the regime of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. President al-Sisi came to power in Egypt after the 2013 coup he led, which removed the 2012 democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Al-Sisi became president in 2014 and was re-elected to that post in 2018. Since al-Sisi's rise to power, the human rights situation in Egypt has steadily and severely deteriorated. Egyptian authorities have arbitrarily detained thousands and prosecuted hundreds in unfair trials, leading in many cases to death sentences. Amnesty International has documented Egypt's system of parallel justice employed against political prisoners in Egypt. That system effectively denies them legal appeal to the right of freedom of expression and participation in public affairs embodied in the Egyptian constitution. Rami Saf is an Egyptian citizen of Palestinian origin and is a well-known political figure and human rights defender. He has exercised his right to advocate for Egyptian and Palestinian political and human rights. He was arrested on July 5, 2019, and has been held in the notorious Tora prison in Cairo. Rami is among hundreds of political prisoners in Egypt. To further discuss Rami's case, as well as the broader human rights context in Egypt, we are joined by Rami Saf's wife and an Amnesty International researcher on Egypt. Celine Lebrun Saf is the wife of Rami Saf and heads the Free Rami Saf campaign. Celine is a political researcher, educator, and community organizer. Since July 2019, following the arrest of her husband, she has been leading an international campaign from France, her home country, for his release. Celine was deported from Egypt at the time of her husband's arrest. She has been a teaching fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Executive Education. Ihsan Bayoumi is the Amnesty International Egypt and Libya researcher. He researches human rights violations, plans and conducts advocacy programs, plans and implements global campaigns, engages with media, and supports Amnesty International's growth in Egypt. He has worked in Cairo, Bogota, and Washington, D.C., where he has covered human rights and political issues in North Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. Welcome, Selim and Hussein.
Welcome, Noura.
Welcome.
Selim, I'd like to begin with you. You recently returned from Egypt, where you visited Rami for the first time since his arrest 19 months ago. Obviously, this has had a tremendous personal impact, and our hearts are with you. Can you give us an overview of Rami's case, perhaps beginning with the circumstances of his arrest?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Noura, for your support. And so the arrest happened on July 5th, 2019, in the middle of the night, like most of the times. They came, they did not present any warrant. They started searching the place. Rami and I were asking, like, where were they there in the apartment? We were wondering, would they just search the place, confiscate laptops, computer? Would they arrest Rami? Nobody gave us any explanation to that answer. No answer. They seized the computers, the laptops, the hard disks. And when they went to take my own belongings, you know, I said, I didn't see a warrant, and as a French citizen residing legally in Egypt, I'm asking to be able to call my consulate because this doesn't seem right to me. And the answer that was made was, well, since you want to call your consulate, you have 10 minutes to pack a bag and we'll take you to the airport. And if you refuse, we'll take you as you are, showing, you know, this sign that they will holding, and we'll take you at the airport. Also, so obviously Rami, fearing for my safety and preferring, you know, to know me safe and somewhere in France, asked that I do what they were asking. And so I did pack a bag, and at the moment, when the moment came to say goodbye and to leave, that's when they told Rami, well, you're coming with us too. And so that's when we realized he was being arrested. So I saw him, you know, they pushed him into a van, me into another one, and for 19 months I didn't see Rami. I was able to see him only a few weeks ago, in early February 2021, which is a long, long time. And during all this period, we were allowed to speak only twice by phone. So right after this night, obviously I was held at the airport for like 7 hours because it was the middle of the night. There were no flights, so they held me in a room, prevented me from calling anyone, and then literally just escorted me to the plane. There I was able to quickly call family to learn that Rami was missing. We didn't know where he was. And he went missing for 36 hours. So he was victim of enforced disappearance, which is common practice, unfortunately. And then it simply reappeared in front of the state security prosecutor. He hadn't been allowed to call a lawyer. By chance, a lawyer was there at the time, was able to attend the interrogation. The interrogation resolved only and around, you know, his political activities. Did he participate to the protest in 2011, 2013? For who did he vote over the past years? This kind of questions. Nothing to do with the case we then discovered he was being added to, which is a very famous case known as the Hope case. And maybe Hussein can tell more about this specific case. But basically, a case that gathered a lot of political figures, lawyers, activists, being accused of terrorist-related charges. And since then, he's been in pretrial detention or remand detention because we don't even know if there is ever going to be a trial. Unfortunately, that's here again common practice. People have been calling that, you know, being put in the fridge. You're just being put in remand detention for months and years with no end in sight. This pretrial detention is renewed. First, it was renewed every 15 days for 150 days by the prosecutor. So Rami for 150 days did not see, not even a judge. And then after 150 days, it had to be renewed by a judge for 45 days. And we're now reaching the 22nd renewal in total in a little bit more than a year and a half. So it's a real parody of justice. Sometimes Rami is not even present in this renewal hearings. Sometimes his lawyer cannot even, you know, speak. So that's the situation we're faced. In 4 months, Rami will reach the end of the two-year legal, I put because there is nothing legal in being put in remand detention for 2 years, but I mean, according to Egyptian law, it is legal. So then comes the question, what will happen then? Normally, Rami should be released. Unfortunately, what we have seen over the past years is that activists are being what we call recycled into new cases. And so they go on and on being detained for no reason.
Ehsen, before we turn to you to ask you to provide us with this broader context, Selina, I want to ask you just, I know that Rami, from my own personal experience, has been a leader in boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns on behalf of Palestinian rights in Egypt, and that this was a point of controversy as well. Has it come up in the course of the trial, or is it swept to the side?
No, so Rami officially, as I was able to mention, is, you know, the accusations against him relate to terrorist charges, which is the usual accusations being brought against any kind of political activist, human rights defender, etc. At no point is political activities delegitimized because they are legitimate, and the Egyptian government knows that very well, and so that's why they are making those trumpet charge, because they know they can't sue Rami for defending Egyptian or Palestinian rights. So it hasn't come up, I mean, officially, but obviously then we can look at the chronology of what happened, and the reality is that 10 days before Rami's arrest, there was the Bahrain conference, which was part of the, you know, Trump's deal of the century, and Rami was being very vocal against this, and he criticized Egypt's participation to this conference. So one can ask, you know, when he's being arrested 10 days later, it's easy to do the connection.
Indeed, no, that's hard to deny. And also the point that you make about the trumped up charges of terrorism, it is a charge that's been weaponized, certainly in Egypt and across, you know, the Middle East, and not unique there. Obviously, it's very common in the United States and beyond as well. So Ehsen, this is, you know, a great pivot to you to tell us about these human rights, you know, the context, the broader context of human rights. If you can, start by providing us an overview of the condition of political prisoners in Egypt, and not limited to al-Sisi, but beginning under Mubarak, as well as under Morsi, and now Sisi. And perhaps if you can provide us with, to help us better understand that condition, put Egypt's treatment and practice of detaining political prisoners relative to other countries.
Sure. So yes, I mean, looking at the issue of the detention of political prisoners in Egypt, it's quite a very old issue in Egypt, unfortunately. I mean, we can go all the way back, but I mean, just looking at Mubarak's final years in power, It's very important to remember that a lot of what we are dealing with in Egypt right now, it is a lot of the legacy of the system and institutions that Mubarak created and empowered during his rule. Under Mubarak, for example, administrative detention. At that time, the authorities, they had the power to administratively detain people, that is, detain anyone just on the basis of suspicion, and they did not need at that time to do the facade of the terrorism charges, so they could just detain them. And they detained thousands, possibly tens of thousands. At that time, also, there was much less communication or much less access to information, so we don't know the full impact of Mubarak's regime in terms of the violations that they have committed. But from what we know that thousands or possibly tens of thousands were arrested. They were tortured, very similar methods to today. It's possible that some of the same people actually are the same people that, well, they have grown up now. So they're probably ordering the arrests rather than conducting the arrests. It's important to note that at that time, the prosecution and judiciary, I mean, people were being prevented from seeing them at the time, because in many cases, you would actually see judges actually ordering the release of people from administrative detention. The night raids were very common, so usually the police would raid, at the time it wasn't the NSA, it wasn't the National Security Agency, it was the State Security Investigations, which is the same name that is being used colloquially in Egypt, or Amn al-Dawla, and they would do these night raids to arrest people, detain them in undisclosed locations for some time, and then they would, you know, like they would, like their families would know that they are administratively detained, and then they would stay there for a long time. Even when judges would order the release, sometimes the Ministry of Interior would refuse to release them. Now, after the revolution, this was obviously one of the big issues that has been raised during that time. However, we saw that, unfortunately, none of the governments that followed Mubarak's government, be it the Supreme Council for Armed Forces or even Mohamed Morsi's government, actually took measures to end or restrict the power of the Ministry of Interior to detain people. They did not take measures to actually properly investigate and hold individuals that were responsible for these violations accountable. And therefore, we saw that a lot of these violations also continued during their rule. But then came the removal of President Morsi from power in 2013. And then we saw a really unprecedented crackdown in terms of brutality and magnitude, because we could see, I mean, first what happened was Rabaa was killing of hundreds of protesters, unarmed protesters, during the dispersal, and then the rounding up of tens of thousands of prisoners. Now, initially, what the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi were doing initially, that they would actually detain tens of thousands, and then they would refer people to trial over a lot of charges. Actually, the vast majority of those that were referred to trial at the time even were not accused of violence. Instead, they were accused of things like membership in a terrorist group, protesting, destruction of property, and so on. But then they were faced with a problem at the time, because the court, the Constitutional Court in Egypt, it ruled that administrative detention is illegal, is unconstitutional, and therefore the security forces, they did not have the power since 2013 to actually detain people administratively. So they needed to have like a cause, a legal cause. Now, when they tried referring them to trial, what they realized is that the Court of Cassation, one of the highest courts in Egypt, it actually ruled that the evidence being used, which was secret NSA investigation file, like a secret police report, did not amount to proper evidence and cannot be used to convict people, which meant that a lot of the cases that were being prosecuted at the time, they ended up losing them. So the Court of Cassation would acquit people, order retrials, and so on. So beginning from 2017, we saw the Egyptian security forces increasingly relying on this specialized system. So they have the Supreme State Security Prosecution, which is a specialist prosecution that's responsible for terrorism cases only, and then there is also terrorist circuits judges, which are a very very limited number of circuits. So it was 9 initially, but basically the judges were chosen and vetted by the Egyptian authorities. And likewise, the prosecutors of the SPs, their numbers is very low, and also it is vetted to a large degree. And it's important to note that actually some of those who work there, for example, they are connected, I mean, family members of very high-ranking individuals.
Hussein, I want to interrupt you briefly. I really appreciate the level of detail and analysis that you're providing us, which demonstrates clearly that this isn't just about, you know, political hubris, that there are legal mechanisms at play that facilitate this process and serve to internally legitimate this oppressive status quo. Can we take a bit of a level out, take a step back to provide a bigger picture for us about, you know, something that Celine mentioned regarding the Hope case and the roundup of particular actors, as well as how Egypt compares to other countries who follow similar practices?
So since 2015, what has begun is that the security forces would just arrest, again, people, and then they would accuse them of terrorism. And accuse is more accurate than charging, because they're actually, the vast majority of these SSP cases, there are actually no trials. There is no even intention to move to trial, because, again, they know there is no evidence. So they accuse people on the basis of these secret investigation files. They subject them to enforced disappearances for very long periods. It could take years. In a recent case, a mother and her baby were subjected to enforced disappearances for almost 2 years. I mean, the child, when he appeared finally after 23 months, he didn't know anyone except his mother and the security officials. He didn't know his family. He didn't know him. He didn't shower at all during that time. It was weird to see a shower, for example. So during that time, people are being tortured, being abused. Their families don't know their fate. In some cases, even some of them are killed by security forces and accused of being members of militant groups. And the security forces, they have been using this system to detain political opponents. For example, in the Hope case, which refers to, this was the idea is that because as the security forces like eradicated most of its opponents, so a small number of politicians from leftist and center-left and centrist parties, they were looking into forming a coalition called the Hope Coalition to run for elections. Now, of course, the Egyptian government will not accuse people of running for elections, so simply they accuse them of terrorism. But also to make the case, and because you do have these cases which are seen referred to as fridges, so basically you add up so many names in the case. So this case, for example, it has tens of people that there is absolutely no connections between them, and the major again, evidence being used against them is the secret NSA investigation file, which is just 2 pages written by an officer, basically. That's it. That's why they are detained. And since then, what happens is that there has been, first, it's a prosecutor assumes the power of a judge, which is unacceptable from an international law point of view, for 150 days. And then they would detain, they order their detention. Nowadays, it has become increasingly worse, because nowadays, I mean, people, defendants only see the prosecutor one time when they appear in front of the prosecutor, but then they don't see the prosecutor anymore for 150 days, and neither does the lawyer talk to the prosecutor about the case. They just renew the detention on paper without the presence of anyone. And then the case goes to a judge, and when it goes to a judge, it's in 45 intervals. Even when judges, I mean, it's important to know that in 2020, the rate of judges granting, in these cases, releasing people, it was 3.2%. So it's 3.2% of almost 22,000 cases, basically. And even when judges do that, the NSA can simply ignore them by filing new accusations. You can subject people to enforced disappearance in a practice called rotation or recycling or revolving doors. And then they accuse them of new charges, which are basically the same charges. And then they are detained over and over, basically the same case. And they go through this system once more. So. And this system, I mean, if you compare Egypt, for example, to other countries in the region, and if you mean like Libya would come naturally, here, of course, it's a very different context. But actually, there are some very sad similarities. For example, in the conditions of detention, some of the conditions of detention that I have been hearing from Egypt are actually similar to some of the conditions of detention that I have been hearing in Libya. And it's very sad to see, to hear that, for example. But also, I mean, the detention without trial, maybe the difference, because Libya also, they have lots of prolonged arbitrary detention without charges. Maybe the difference between Egypt and Libya in that aspect is that Egypt actually, you know, like they try to put a facade on it, in the sense that you have this terrorism charges, where in Libya they don't necessarily bother with that as much, but in the actual thing, which is the detention of people because of their political opinions, the arbitrary detention, there isn't really that much difference between Egypt and other repressive countries in the region or beyond.
Thank you for providing that overview, Hassan, and indeed the condition of arresting political prisoners is quite sad and represents a way that many states use carceral regimes in order to squash their political opposition. And so that's a good segue for us to think about the broader context in Egypt as well. Many analysts would agree that the ascendance of Sisi was a counter-revolution, and it specifically used its power, which it consolidated, in order to target, arrest, attack, delegitimize the very individuals, organizations, movements that toppled Mubarak in the first place. Would you agree with that assessment, and are you seeing this as an ongoing trend?
I mean, it's very clear the priorities of the current president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, when he took power back in 2013. I mean, at that time, in the very early days, at that time, there was a need from the point of view of the military and President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, well, at that time not president yet, but basically there was a need for, you know, the revolution's youth. There was a need to show that there was actually opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood, and that this, in a sense, the military saw that this could be used to justify the takeover of power and the arrest of the Muslim Brotherhood leadership. But also it was very clear that this relationship is not going to last, because it was also very clear from the very first days that the new government doesn't want to share power. It was very clear that this government is going to be authoritarian. Now, it did not need to be as bloody as it is. I mean, there are other authoritarian regimes that are not as bloody or as violent as the Egyptian government. So, but there were also factors that contributed that. For example, the international climate for, under President Trump, for example, in the coming years after, it actually facilitated what happened, a lot of the violations that happened in Egypt. The fact that the Egyptian government were able to play their cards in relation to migration, for example, talking so much about how much they are controlling migration, how much they would spend on weapon purchases from Europe. This all gives them kind of a blank check that have allowed them over the last few years to really crack down on a lot of their opponents. And now if you look to at where are the activists and human rights defenders that were at the forefront of the revolution in 2011, well, a lot of them are in prison. So when President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, for example, asks where are the youth, I mean, they are in prison, or you have forced them to leave the country, or they are afraid to go back, because you have someone like Ziad al-Alimi, one of the leading figures in 2011. He is in prison now for the same charges as Rami, and in the same case, actually, Ziad Ala Abdel Fattah, he's in prison now over, and he was tortured in prison. And now when also the president asks where the students and the smart young people and so on, well, they are either in prison or they are afraid. I mean, we saw how a student, Ahmed Samir, a student of gender and religion who doesn't have really a political profile, he was arrested and he was questioned about what he is studying, why is he studying gender, what does he mean about abortion and so on. So really the government has crushed the use of the revolution. They are actually trying to undermine the revolution until this day. I mean, they are still trying to brutalize people who led the revolution, were active in the revolution, to really send a very clear message, which is that the government does not accept any sort of criticism or opposition, and it will go to a great lengths, even if it means targeting family members, even if it means torture, even if it means unlawful killings to silence its opponents.
Celine, Hussein mentioned a number of Rami's contemporaries who are also involved in the Egyptian revolution, like Abdel Fattah. I want to ask you specifically, do you think that the targeting of Rami has to do with his role during the revolution as well?
I don't know if Rami's involvement in the revolution and the important role he played in co-founding a lot of movements were leading in this attempt to for democratic transition what's clear is that there has been, Rami has been arrested by the Egyptian government for many years, starting in 1990 at the time of the first Gulf War and his peaceful protest at university. And then the government, the state security attempted to, you know, deprive him of his passport and then give him just 1 year passport renewable every year. And like other Egyptians who have a 7 years passport, he would have just 1 year passport renewable, not at the normal administrative building, but at the state security building. And this went on for 30 years. In 2012, as a measure of reprisal against him and other activists, recordings of his voice were and other activists' voice were circulated on social media and used to, you know, interrogate them and accusing them of attempting, you know, some kind of a plot or like threatening the security of the regime. And Rami was interrogated in this case, and he was banned from travel. His passport was confiscated. Then, obviously, thankfully, an independent sound expert was able to prove that the recordings were
doctored, edited.
Yes, edited. Yes, please. Yeah. Spliced and other things. So the judge ordered, you know, Rami's passport to be given to him. Then the Ministry of Interior started saying that Rami is not Egyptian, is only Palestinian, and then started a case to try to strip him of his nationality. And this case is actually still ongoing. Despite the fact that he won, actually, a first time in a year later, in 2013, he won, and the judge ordered that Rami be given a 7 years passport, and he excused, you know, he presented his excuse for the 30 years of harassment, but the Ministry of Interior appealed this decision, and the appeal is still ongoing. So there is a long history of harassment against Rami. I don't know if this history was directly related to the decision on July 5th to arrest Rami, but it might have appeared as, you know, an opportunity to both come after someone who's been vocal in the revolution and active in the revolution, and recently have kept being vocal, especially when it comes to Egypt's external policy regarding Israel and Palestine.
So as we zoom out also and we're thinking about the region, it's imperative upon us to also think about the U.S.'s role. There has been so much critique from the most authoritarian Arab states of the Obama administration supposedly abandoning, you know, Egypt or Mubarak during the revolution. And we see then in the tenure of Trump, of the Trump administration, that it, you know, consolidated its support for not just the Egyptian, you know, regime, but as well for these other authoritarian regimes and its reconfiguration of the Middle East, and, you know, certainly its withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement as part of that reconfiguration. So many people have been, you know, sighing, exhaling the sigh of relief upon now the ascendance of a Biden administration, except we've seen from the earliest signs of the Biden administration that it's not offering much hope, but it's actually talking out of both sides of its mouth, wherein on the one hand, it's acknowledging and critiquing Egypt for, you know, its violation of human rights, that, you know, what it sees is a dictatorship, and on the other hand, it's just renewed another $200 million aid package. So do you have, for both Celine and Hassan, what is your sense of what's to come from the Biden administration? Do you have any hope in it or any fears as a result of it?
Let's look at this from the point of view of Egyptian. I think when you, the thing is, we're comparing Biden now, the Biden administration, now it is immediately compared to the Trump administration. Now, the Trump administration was really a disaster in human rights in Egypt. And I cannot stress how much it was, because not only did the Trump administration prevent the U.S. from playing an important role in human rights in Egypt, but and actually supported the president of Tahsisi in a lot of circumstances, but this action actually it facilitated or it made European states and other states that might have been encouraged to speak about human rights or pressured by the U.S. to take a stronger human rights position in Egypt not to do so. So it was much easier for Egypt to go to Europe when the U.S. was no longer in the equation to say, well, we are controlling migration, and therefore it was much easier also for European diplomats, European officials to justify that, saying that, well, we can't, like, the U.S. is not doing anything also. Now, with the Biden administration, I mean, we were seeing hopeful signs. So we saw there were tweets, there were lots of talk about human rights in Egypt. But now the important thing is that the new administration is here. There is a lot that can be done. There is, one of the closest opportunities for the U.S. to show if it's really serious about human rights in Egypt. Well, one very simple call is that we are calling on the international community, including the U.S., to establish a monitoring and reporting mechanism through the United Nations Human Rights Council in the sessions that have just started today, to be running on across March. And the time is not, I mean, there is still time to do that or to take joint action through the United Nations Human Rights Council. So this is a very important test that we'll be seeing, whether the Biden administration is willing to actually do something about that or just stop at talking. As for also in relation to arms exports, I mean, we are hoping to see that the administration will ensure that no arms that could be used in committing human rights violations are exported to Egypt at all. We need to make sure that they also need to make sure that when exporting any sort of equipment and arms, to do a proper human rights assessment to ensure that this equipment will not be used in committing human rights violations. And it's important to note that Egypt's human rights violations are also not limited to its borders, but also, for example, in Libya, we have seen evidence of Egyptian equipment being used by the Libyan Arab Armed Forces, an armed group that is trying to take over, that was trying to take over the government. And they have also allowed the United Arab Emirates to launch, to conduct airstrikes from bases inside Egypt. And also they have allowed the UAE to transport weapons to the same armed groups from the same air base in Egypt. So now we need to see action from the U.S. In relation to these measures. Also, we need to ensure to see how the U.S. will ensure that human rights are at the center of its deals with Egypt, for example, to ensure that no deal would lead to human rights violations, and to ensure that Egypt upholds its commitment to ensure that civil society actually participates in cooperation agreements with or development in Egypt, for example, on issues like women, issues like as any of the programs that the U.S. wants to actually implement in Egypt, you need to make sure that there is proper civil society participation in this, and real civil society, not gongos, but actual human rights organizations that are now facing an unprecedented crackdown on them. So only time will tell whether the Biden administration will stand up for, will actually do something, or just to stand at words.
Celine, would you like to add anything to that?
I agree with what Hussein has said. I think the Biden administration is bringing about hope, but I would say it's also on the lawmakers, the U.S. lawmakers, also to keep pushing in the right direction. I mean, we've seen an unprecedented mobilization over the past months from U.S. lawmakers who've been calling, on for a revision, some kind of revision of the strategic relationship between Egypt and the U.S. in the light of human rights violations that are being committed. In October, over like 56 senators and representatives have signed an open letter to President El-Sisi. Recently in January, a caucus on Egypt Human Rights has been launched, which is not a small thing, in December. The annual military aid is being delivered to Egypt, but for the first time, we've seen 75 million of this 1.3 billion. Okay, it's a drop, but that's still that. So 75 million of this military aid being conditioned without the possibility of a waiver to the release of political prisoners. So not just human rights, because already 300 million of this aid is conditioned to human rights. But now we're not talking about just human rights in general. We're talking really about the release of political prisoners, which means that this issue has really reached, you know, it's on top of the files that need to be addressed. And I really do wish Egypt hear this message. We're not asking for much here. We're asking for people who have, who shouldn't have spent one day in prison, who should be looked by Egypt as a real source of wealth. I mean, people like Romy, who is also a businessman, who's been investing and you know, creating a lot of wealth for Egypt, they should be honored, not thrown in prison. And so I do hope that Egypt will hear this plight and will release Romy and all the Egyptian political prisoners who should not be in prison.
Absolutely. I think it's really powerful to emphasize that these political prisoners shouldn't have been in prison for one day, let alone the time that they have spent there. Celine, I mean, the accomplishments that you mention about this reaching the highest levels of office, you know, motivating the creation of a caucus, you know, letter, an open letter sent to Assisi, obviously represents the work of tireless movement activity, of tireless advocates like yourself, like Hassan, of organizations. Can you tell us about a dimension of that work in regards to Rami's case? What is going on to continue advocating for his release and to shed light on his case?
So, well, it's a relentless work day and night, honestly, since the time of Rami's arrest. I haven't found any rest, and I won't rest until Rami is out. And that's also something I hope the Egyptian government will hear and will understand. They are our family, they are our loved ones, and so there is absolutely, we're not going to give up on them. So today, what's next? So thankfully, I've been able to go and see Rami in Egypt. This has come as a small victory after a lot of engagement, especially with the French government. Now we'll keep asking for this release. With Amnesty International, we've launched an international petition in the U.S., in France, also across the Arab world, in Morocco, Algeria, and so we're already now, this petition has gathered, you know, several thousands of signatures, and the numbers will keep increasing. And we'll keep engaging with all the offices in the U.S., in France, who've been supporting us so far at the European level as well. We have a very important date coming up for us, which is March 10th. We are expecting the court decision, the cassation court decision in the appeal against the decision to add Rami to the terrorist list. It's a decision that came, that was made by the prosecutor. So here we see the role of the prosecutor, who can just, as if it was an administrative procedure, add people to the terrorist list, something that has huge consequences for people. On people's life. So we're hoping to see Rami removed from this list. The UN the UN experts have issued a very powerful statement on February 11th, one day after the hearing, calling for Rami and Ziad Al-Alimi, the former parliamentarian and human rights defender, to be also removed from this list and to be released immediately. So we're going to keep doing what we've been doing for the past year, which is raising Rami's case in any way and any occasion we can.
Celine, for people watching who want to know how to help further, can you direct them where they can find the petition or other resources?
Yes, of course. So we have the campaign's website, so freeramishaz.com, and there people can find a lot of information and resources, especially on how to take action, and including the link to the petition. And I also invite people to look at Amnesty's website for that. But everything is on the freeramishaz.com website.
Celine, power to you. May you find rest. May you be reunited with Rami. May all political prisoners be free, as activists in the United States have said in regards to the U.S.'s carceral regime, it's a call to free them all. So may they all be free. Thank you for joining us today and for sharing your story. Thank you, Ehsan, for your tireless work, your advocacy, and your remarkable attention to technical detail. You have taught us all so much. So strength to you as well as you continue on this mission. To the audience, thank you for joining us today on the Arabic Hour and Jadaliyah. Please stay tuned. Look out for the petition that Celine has mentioned in regards to Rami's case, as well as keep a close eye on the situation in Egypt. Thank you.
You have been listening to an Arabic Hour presentation of a forum on the plight of political prisoner Rami Saf, moderated by Noura Erekat. Okay, get out your schedule calendars. Coming up on March 22nd is World Water Day. The Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine is marking the day with a special virtual celebration webinar they are calling Water, Health, and Human Rights, marking the World Water Day from the U.S. to Palestine. The keynote speaker is Michigan Congressional Representative Rashida Tlaib, who sponsored in Congress the Emergency Water is a Human Right Act. Israel controls the water distribution in Palestine, and although most of it comes from aquifers underneath Palestinian territory, Israel captures it and sells a small portion of it back to Palestinians at four times the cost that it sells to Israelis. It is rationed and often not available in Palestine villages, but is always available to fill Israeli swimming pools. But the unavailability of potable water is a global problem, even in the United States. Just ask the folks in Flint, Michigan, and Native Americans on their reservations. So mark Monday, March 22nd on your calendar to participate in World Water Day webinar. To register, check out the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine website and help spread the word through your networks. The website is allianceforwaterjusticeinpalestine.org, all one word. AllianceForWaterJusticeInPalestine.org. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. And thank you for your time. And we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر